Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here is Bob.
Now, I want to talk about this in the context in which it was written, and then I want to comment briefly on how it relates to Jesus' comment in Matthew 19:9. Now notice, this is one of those verses that has been great controversy over about what it means. Because of some of the Hebrew words here. Look what it says. When a man takes a wife and marries her, and it happens that she finds no favor in his eyes because he has found some indecency in her. Well, right there is where the fight began with the rabbis. Two schools of thought that developed in Judaism. One is the rabbinical school of Shammai, and one is the rabbinical school of Hillel. Shammai locked in on this little word, some indecency in her, and said the only grounds for divorce is adultery. The other one, Hillel, locked in to a little phrase, and she found no favor in his eyes, and said you could divorce your wife for anything if she didn't cook the meal right. One rabbi said if you found someone who looked better than she did, you could trade her in. And they allowed divorce for anything, knowing that you do the lustful passions of the human heart. Which group do you think became the normative in Judaism? Hillel, that's right. And it really, this whole idea about finds no favor in his eyes because she has found some indecency. Now we, since I am, it's what known as an exegetical teacher, it's very important to me to know what this little word some indecency means in Hebrew and then in the context. Literally, it means the nakedness of a thing. And you say, oh, it's a moral sexual issue. No. If you look right across the page at chapter 23, verse 17, no, not 17, 23, verse 14, where it says, and we talk about this, when the Lord your God walks through the midst of your camp to deliver you and to defeat your end before you, therefore your camp must be holy, and he must not see anything indecent among you, lest he turn away. And that indecent thing in verse 14 is referring to excrement, human excrement outside the camp being covered up, right? That's the same exact word in verse 14 that's used in verse 1 of chapter 24, and that tells me that we're not talking about a moral issue here. We're talking about something else. Now, what else? I don't know. Now, if it's true that the rabbinical school of Shammai said this is adultery, proven adultery, well, then I want to know what Deuteronomy 22:22 means, where it says if someone's caught in open adultery, they are stoned by the community. The sentence for adultery is stoning. So how can this verse in chapter 24 mean adultery when the automatic penalty was death, and here it says you'll just write her a bill of divorcement? So I think that the school of Shammai was a little off. I think it went too much to the right. And I want to tell you, there's two ditches in the Christian life. That's the right wing and the left wing. Both of them are ditches. And there's a middle road upon which we all got to walk. Now, the right wing Shammai made it adultery, which I don't think it can be. The left wing made it anything, which I don't think it can be. Somewhere in between those, that spectrum, is where I think what we're talking about in a Jewish Old Testament sense. Now, the rabbis were very concerned with this verse because they wanted to make divorce very difficult. And they did it by requiring three different things. One of them is mentioned right here in the verse where it says, and he must write her a certificate of divorce. Now, this means he had to go to some authority, be it a scribe or an elder at the gate or something, to write this up for him in a legal form. And it took some hours. It took some days. There was a time period involved. You couldn't just run down, get mad at your wife and boot her out the same day. It was a legal procedure that they set up to give the old boy a time to think about it and the wife a time to react to it. Number two, which is not mentioned in the text but is involved here, is the guy had to give back the money that he got when he married this lady. See, the lady brought a dowry with her. Well, I want to take it to a Jewish mentality. Giving back the dowry just almost eliminated divorce. They'd keep the old girl just to keep the dowry, you know. And so that was pretty effective. And number three is found, let's see, down here where it says, number four, then her former husband who sent her away is not allowed to take her again. If this girl remarries, and even if her second husband divorces her, or if the second husband dies, she still can't marry the former husband again. Well, that was a real deterrent, too. So we have three basic deterrents here. This is basically a law not on divorce, but on remarriage, because the main clause comes in verse 4, which deals with remarriage, and divorce just happens to be the setting up the case for the fourth verse here. Now, notice in Matthew 19:9, Jesus quotes this verse and uses the word in King James, unchastity. Is that the right word? It is, 19:9, Matthew. Now, what does unchastity mean? You say it means an adultery. No, it doesn't. There is a specific word for adultery. And the Greek word here is the word porneia. We get the English translation fornication from it. You say, well, that's adultery. No, it's really not. This Greek word is used in such a way, at least for the time of Jesus, that it's referring to moral evil on a wider scope, not just infidelity inside a marriage contract, but a much wider meaning. We get the English word pornography from it, but it means a very... It doesn't mean adultery automatically. It can include that, but it includes much more. So Jesus didn't even say except for adultery. He said except for the cause of porneia, which has a wider meaning even than that. Now, I want you to realize that in verse 2, the rabbis are very cute. I get so tickled reading them sometimes. It says, and if she leaves her house and goes and becomes another man's wife. So remarriage is automatically assumed in Jewish culture. I mean, there's no question. This bill of divorcement is a paper that says, I don't want her anymore. She's out of my life. She's free to remarry. So remarriage in the Jewish system is automatic with this bill of divorcement. Now, notice verse 4, which says, and the former husband... No, wait, verse 3. Does your translation have the word if in it? The Hebrew doesn't have the word if. The rabbis would say this. And the latter husband turns against her. They would say, it's not if, it's when. Because any woman that has some indecency in her, the second husband will turn away from. And they even add, this last little part about verse 3, it says, if the husband dies who took her, they would say, she killed him. Her attitude or her nagging or whatever's indecent about her, wipe the old boy out. So the rabbis, they were pretty tough about this. And it is true that the if is not there. And so you need to deal with that some way. Wow. Now, notice what this did for the women. You say, well, it's a male chauvinist verse because only the husband can divorce. Well, that's true. There's a double standard in the Old Testament. If you don't believe that, you haven't read the Old Testament. There is definitely a double standard in the Old Testament. But the Old Testament also tries to be more humanitarian than the cultures around it. So the rights of the woman are what's protected here. A guy just can't kick her out and bring her back and kick her out and bring her back, and she just can't be passed from one guy to the other. This is a built-in way of assuring the dignity of the lady involved as far as they could in a Hebrew structure. Now, later on in Judaism, we know that the wife could get a divorce. And the way she did it was, whatever made the husband mad, she did it over and over again. And finally, he would divorce her, but she would instigate it. And so that's the way that the ladies did it. I think in colloquial expression, it's called a nagging. I'm not sure. Never deal with those things. But anyway, so there was a way. She had a recourse, you know. Now notice in verse 4 where it says the reason that a man could not take his former wife back once she had been remarried again is because he would bring sin on the land. Now that is a strange concept for us. It goes back to the idea of corporality again. Adam's sin not only affected humanity, but Adam's sin affected what? The created order. The ground suffered because of Adam. That's where the deal about all the days of your life, with the sweat of your brow, you eat your bread. My wife thinks that roaches came out of the curse. I think mosquitoes, roaches, and all the rest of those things we don't like must have come from there. Thorn bushes and all the rest. But I'm just saying here that it's the idea that Adam's sin affected not only people but land. And if you'll look at Leviticus 18:25-28, you'll see that it says the reason for the expelling of the Canaanites from the promised land is because of their own personal sin. And so their sin is what caused the land to mourn, and they were expelled. Same thing happened to Israel, so I don't think it's unfair that he did it to one country, did it to anybody who did that. Now, notice verse 5, moving different context, but dealing with marriage still. When a man takes a new wife, and he shall not go out with the army, nor be charged with any duty, he shall be free at home 1 year, and shall give happiness to his wife whom he has taken. Now, notice that in Deuteronomy 20, verses 5 through 8, it lists some reservations that you didn't have to go to the army. If you built a new house, you didn't have to go. If you planted a new vineyard, didn't have to go. If you were afraid, didn't have to go. Now, the rabbis would interpret this way. They would say, well, the guy who's married a wife does not have to go to the army, and he doesn't have to do any civic duties. But the guy who builds a new house, and the guy who plants a new vineyard, the guy who's afraid, he has got to do non-military duty at home. In other words, they give him civil functions to do for not going in the army. Yet the man who's taken a new wife doesn't even have this civic duty, which is the second thing mentioned in verse 5. Notice where it says, the little phrase, and shall give happiness to his wife. There is a targum. It's a translation of the Old Testament, and which translates this, rejoice with his wife. I think that probably fits it better. So notice the importance here again of children and inheritance in Hebrew culture. A guy was let off from the army to have children, you know. The reason for that is that a man lived on his children in the Old Testament sense, and also that the property had to be passed on to children. And so this was a year of procreation. Now, there's expected to be a child out of this year. Children are very important. That's one reason why divorce is so bad, because when the woman is sent away, the children stay with the daddy, because he lives on his children, and they get the property. So children are very important in Hebrew culture. Now notice the verse 6 where it says, no one shall take a handmill or an upper millstone. Now, picture with me, if you will. This is two parts of the same grinding equipment. One of them is shaped like a shallow U, okay? Shallow U. And it's round, and in the middle, a round stone fits in with a cone-shaped hole in the top, and you put the grain in the hole, and you turn the round, big round, with a board or a stick or something, and that grinds the grain between the little shallow U shape and the round thing. And so the Jews said, you can't take the bottom or the top. I think they knew each other well enough to know that fallen natures say, well, God said I couldn't take your millstones, just give me the top part of it. No, you can't take the bottom or the top. A man must keep his millstone because, look what it says, you cannot take a life in pledge. Well, the millstone seems to have been the pledge, or maybe in our terminology, collateral for a loan that someone gave him. Now, the someone who loaned it to him, supposed to be his family member or his tribe or some close kin in the first place. And the fact that this man would take this means of grinding bread, which would deprive the whole family of food, in a way was taking this man's life. And the Old Testament would not allow that. Now, the verse 7 is talking about kidnapping. They're not stealing children, but stealing slaves. Children could be involved, but any Hebrew person's involved. Let's look briefly at Exodus 21:16, which is of course, Deuteronomy is an amplification of this. It says, the one who kidnaps a man, whether he sells him or he is found in his possession, shall surely be put to death. Now, in the Ten Commandments, they're mentioned in Exodus chapter 20, but they're also mentioned in Deuteronomy chapter 5. Deuteronomy 5:19, you shall not steal. Now, you've always heard that, you shall not, you know, steal in the normal sense. But since all the rest of these commandments deal with faithfulness, many people interpret this commandment, you shall not steal your brother or your brethren, and it referring to kidnapping. And I think if you take it in context of what it's doing, I think that's probably a very good interpretation of that. So notice those two things. Notice the guy is called a thief because he steals life. Verse 8 and 9 deal with leprosy. Leprosy in the Old Testament is not the same as modern day leprosy, because leprosy can get in clothes and get in houses. Leviticus 13 to 14 describe how to get leprosy out of your house. Friends, you better hope you don't get leprosy in your stucco, or you've got problems. You're going to be an Old Testament person. And so it is a skin disease of some kind, covered a wide range of discolorations and that kind of thing. Now in Numbers 12, 10 through 15 is where this account of Miriam in verse 9 is mentioned. God did to Miriam on the way as you came out of Egypt. Miriam balked against God. Miriam and Aaron were griping against Moses and didn't like the way this was done, like that was done. And so all of a sudden, El Pufo, Miriam, gets leprosy. And Moses prays, "Oh God, heal Miriam." And God says to Moses, "If Miriam's daddy would have spit in her face, she would have had to been outside the camp for 7 days. Let her stay outside 7 days, then I'll heal her." So she has to be outside 7 days, and God heals her and brings her back in. So it's an account here of leprosy in the Old Testament sense was considered to be the curse of God for some kind of action. Now notice in verse 10 where it says, When you make your neighbor a loan of any sort, you shall not enter his house to take a pledge. Isn't it interesting? The Old Testament provides for the privacy and sanctuary of a man's own home. A lender could not enter a man's home and take what he wanted as a pledge. He had to go and knock on the door, and the man could bring him the pledge, but he could not enter on his own. Verse 11, look at verse 12. If he is a poor man, you shall not sleep with his pledge. This is talking about the outer cloak that the people took off in the daytime to work in. They didn't work in it, but they wore it whenever between work. And they slept in it at night. It was a large covering, like a blanket with a hole in the middle. And if someone took that for a pledge, they'd have to return it before sundown. And that's mentioned also in Exodus 22, verses 26 and 27. Notice again the humanitarian nature of Deuteronomy. The poor are concerned about that. And the women are concerned about, they're concerned about all these people's rights. Now notice in verse 13 where it says, about the sun going down and all. And the last part says, it will be righteousness for you before the Lord your God. Now, the word righteousness, this is the word in Hebrew, it's in all contexts, it's usually translated righteousness. But the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Old Testament, translates it almsgiving. For in a real sense, the Jews understood giving to the poor as a way for God to look favorably on them. And that's a historical understanding. And notice again that God is pleased with the simple kindness of his people toward others. Matter of fact, I can go further than that. On Judgment Day in Matthew 25, God's question is, did you go to church? Were you faithful? Did you tithe? When did you accept me? Were you baptized? He didn't even ask that on Judgment Day. He says, I was hungry and you didn't feed me. And I was naked and you didn't clothe me. And I was in prison and you didn't visit me. And I was sick and you didn't help me. And so God looks on the life of the Christian for his love and yieldedness. Now notice, if you will, in verse 14, it deals with a hired servant again. And the whole context is that you should pay him the same day. Notice where it talks about you should not oppress a hired servant who is poor and needy when he is one of your countrymen or one of the aliens, your aliens. And this word alien is talking about resident aliens, someone who is a foreigner but lives in the land, is probably a proselyte to Judaism. And so, here, again, this humanitarian understanding for strangers in your midst, if you would. Notice verse 15. You shall give him his wages on the day before the sun goes down. Now, this is mentioned in Leviticus 19:13, Malachi 3:5, and James 5:4. Because, see, the employers used to keep the guy's money and say, if I keep the money, he'll have to come back tomorrow and work for me, so I'll just keep it till the morning. But the poor guy had to support his family day by day. And it was a real hardship for that employer to hold that money. So God says, you pay him the day he works. Now, notice the little phrase in the last, that he may not cry against you to the Lord. I want to tell you, God hears the cries of his people. And since I believe in a special way in the next context that God is concerned with those who are helpless, say the alien, the widow, and the orphan, if you're going to abuse somebody, you best abuse somebody who is of your own socioeconomic group. You better leave the widows, orphan, and helpless alone, because God fights their battles. And when they cry to him, friends, I want to tell you, God hears in a very special way, and he reacts to their needs. So next time you put up your nose at a poor person or something, just remember, God loves the poor and the helpless and the needy. Now, verse 16 is a tremendously, tremendously significant verse. I want you to read it and tell me why. Why should that be starred and underlined and asterisked and everything else you can do? What is so significant about verse 16 in Old Testament theology? Corporate. Yeah. Now, we've got to admit that at this early part in the Old Testament, we've got two strands, don't we? We've got that corporality. We talked about that over here with the land expelling the inhabitants for sinning. And we've got that individual responsibility. Let me ask you a question. Turn back with me briefly to Deuteronomy 5:9, just for a moment. Deuteronomy 5:9. And you shall not worship them or serve them, for I am the Lord your God. I am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children and on the third and fourth generations of those who hate me. And look, if you would, briefly at just chapter 23 of Deuteronomy, just the chapter before this, verses 2 and 3. They shall not enter the assembly of the Lord, none of his descendants, even to the tenth generation, shall never enter the assembly of the Lord. And then the Amorite, the next one, to the tenth generation shall never enter the assembly of the Lord. Let me ask you a question. If God does not visit the sins of the father on the children, why does God hold the iniquity of the idolater to the third and fourth generation? And why does God hold it against national groups like the Amorites and the other group mentioned there to the tenth generation if God deals on individual level? How so, Truett? Yeah, of course, the implication is that the parents die and don't repent, that the children will get it to the third and fourth generation. Yeah. Okay, that's a thought. Repentance is involved, okay. Any other thought? Yes, Edwina. That's like the argument that what I'm doing doesn't affect anybody, I just do it. It's such a ridiculous argument because we are involved in many, many people's lives. So the concept of corporality is a good spiritual concept, but it seems like the sin of idolatry is the one that's especially mentioned that leaves lasting consequences. The only way I know how to reconcile it, if I can, is this way. The lifestyle transmitted by the father or the parents is usually picked up by the children. I write a letter to everybody in Lubbock who has a baby in Lubbock County. A letter goes something like this. We're glad your parents and had this great responsibility and on it goes. And then the last part, I mention this. I hope you're involved in worship somewhere in Lubbock, for the priorities of the parents tend to be the priorities of the children. That's true. And so the idea about the God visiting iniquity, I agree with Truett. It's an idea of repentance. If the children turn, I think God would turn. But the idea is usually we transmit a lifestyle to our children. Good or evil, usually we transmit it. And so the other deal about the individual responsibility is a brand new item so far in the Pentateuch. It comes out marvelously in the prophets. Ezekiel 14, 12 through 20, and Ezekiel, the whole chapter of 18, in Jeremiah 31, all individual responsibility. Many folks say, well, individual responsibility developed with the 8th century prophets but was unknown in Moses' day. Yeah, well, who wrote verse 16? It's always been a concept. It wasn't clearly revealed or clearly discussed or clearly set out as over against corporality till later. But it's from the very beginning it has been that a father... Now, the Jews interpret this way. They say that a father cannot be killed on the testimony of his son, or the son be killed on the testimony of the father, because they say it takes two witnesses. So they totally interpret this along different lines. They would say it's talking about the need for two witnesses to convict. I think it's talking about individual responsibility. And so you can relate that to your understanding of the Old Testament. Notice verse 17, alien, orphan, widow. Notice verse 19, alien, orphan, widow. Notice verse 20, alien, orphan, widow. Notice verse 21, alien, orphan, widow. Man, I want to tell you, God is for those people. And this is a very humanitarian passage. When it says in verse 18, remember that you were a slave in Egypt when the Lord your God redeemed you from there, and therefore I am commanding you to do this thing. God's saying, I loved you first. Love others. Well, that's pretty New Testament. I redeemed you from Egypt. Now I expect you to live in a gratitude relationship with other people because of what I've done for you. That same phrase is mentioned in verse 22. Because you were slaves in Egypt, therefore I command you to do this thing. He's saying, you've been there, you know how it is. Now treat other people as you want to be treated. Put it that way. Love, because I loved you first. Now, in verse 19, the word sheaf is mentioned. This is gleaning. You see a perfect example in Ruth chapter 2. It's also mentioned in Leviticus 19, 9 through 11, I think, 9 and 10, and in Leviticus 23, 22, about not reaping to the corners of your field, but leaving some for the poor. Now, the Jews, being very practical, would say that the sheaf mentioned in verse 19 is not the big sheaf, because that would be unpractical, but it's a little sheaf. You wouldn't want to leave a big sheaf for the poor, you know, that'd be wasteful, but leave them little sheaves. Notice in verse 20 it says, beat your olive tree. Olives tend to fall off when they get ripe, and if you're growing olives for oil, you wait till they get ripe because you get more oil out of them. And so they would pick the majority off the ground, but the ones that didn't, they'd get a long stick and beat the olive tree, knock them loose. And what the law here is don't beat the olive tree the second time. If any are stuck on there, leave them for the poor. Okay? And then the same thing is true of your grape vineyard. Leave a little sour green ones for the poor, and they'll mature later and they can have something to eat. Okay. Do you have questions or comments? Yes. Is that right? Just the opposite, isn't it? Tamara, how do you think this chapter applies to your life at all? Do you feel like any of this applies? But you hadn't beat the olive tree twice, have you? Yes. Boy, if you had, I'd have been, you know. What do you do with this chapter? How do you walk the streets of Lubbock with this chapter? You know, to me, it just shines with a love for people who don't have the privileges the rest have. I mean, you just see God's heart saying, these don't have anybody to help them. I'm going to help them. You know, I like that. I saw a hand over here. Dave, was that you? I agree with that. Tell you the truth, if welfare stopped today, the church would not pick it up tomorrow, because it would take a great commitment of time, money, and effort. Which, what always kills me is, now I know that Juana is a welfare worker, and I appreciate her, but many welfare workers are not Christians. They do for humanitarian reasons what Christians will not do for their love for Jesus. That will put us to shame. God loves people. Yeah? I want to mention that. I got a letter the other day. If any of you are sending me chain letters, please don't. I go through the roof on chain letters, especially ones that threaten death if I don't pass them on. Boy, I just get furious with that.
You know, that's nothing more than a modern little good luck taboo, you know. If you write 10 more letters, boy, you'll be rich in 4 days. But boy, if you don't, God's going to sock it to you, because this little letter came from Malaysia. And 4 people have died, and 3 have got leprosy, and 2 had their tongues cut out. And don't send me those letters. Send them to your mother-in-law. Do not send them to me. I don't want the prophet nor the curse. And I just get furious with them, so please. That's a little idle, you know. A little good luck charm. Of course, we don't ever do that. Okay. Any other comments? There's a lot of things here you might be interested in if you're just willing to talk to somebody. Anybody? Yes, Jamie. Well, I have a balancing statement there. If Jesus talks on something in the New Testament, we've got to go with him. And what he did when he was asked specifically about this verse, we left this verse with this comment. Moses only did it because you were so hard-hearted. But it's always been God's plan. He goes back to Genesis 1 about marriage being one flesh concept, a uniting that can't be broken. So I really think that the church has got to hold up the ideal, although we love and deal with those who have unfortunately had to face the brokenness of the ideal. We have to say, God's will is one man, one wife. Matter of fact, in Malachi 2, God says, I hate divorce. So this was a deal, I think, to give women a little more legal status, not to condone divorce, but to say, you're already doing it so much, anyway, let's give it some guidelines. And so, yeah. Yeah. I think we've got a problem in our culture in this sense. I really feel like that we've got a trial attitude about marriage that's become prevalent that says, well, we'll give it a whack. Doesn't work. We'll try again. Now, I think you all know that I am not down divorcees or divorce or anything, but I am saying we need to hold up the ideal, and the way we can do it is 2 ways, and I'll get very practical with you. To deal with our young people in extensive witnessing roles as loving couples, the best education is not what you tell them, it's what you show them. And if you have a loving, vibrant marriage, that's the best witness against divorce there is. Number 2, that we ought to, in a real sense, continue and move forward in our move on marriage enrichment in the church. We need to send our couples as fast as we can through marriage enrichment. An ounce of prevention in marriage enrichment is worth all the counseling in the world in divorce. Okay? And number 3, we need to develop and develop further a time of courtship and discovery and talking among our young people that they will know who they're marrying. You know what I mean? Now, there's always things that come up. There's alcoholism and mental illness and abuse, and I understand that, but I'm saying if we knew each other better before we got married, and if we realized that love is a commitment, not a feeling, and if we took the time to improve our own marriages instead of let a lot of them stagnate and get bad ourselves, we wouldn't have the divorce problem in the church.